This week on Making Contact.
These are the most egregious crimes. Torture, lawless spying on American citizens, massive fraud, an aggressive attack on another country, and yet we have repudiated the rule of law when it comes to elite lawbreakers.
Americans claim to live under the rule of law, that no one is above our system of justice. But as we witness more exceptions to that rule, there are growing doubts that fairness is a value we as a nation still hold dear.
What people are angry about is that these inequalities have become unjust because the people winning are not winning because they earned it or because they deserved it. They're winning because they're cheating.
On this edition, author Glenn Greenwald talks about his book, With Liberty and Justice for Some. I'm Andrew Stelzer, and this is Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information.
I am currently in the middle of my book tour, where I'm going around to different cities and across the country and speaking at venues like this about the argument of my book, that the United States has witnessed the complete evisceration of the rule of law. I try to begin by asking, what is it that we even mean when we refer to the rule of law? People will say, media figures and political figures and the like will often say, oh, of course, the rule of law is very important. I believe in the rule of law. And yet very rarely is there any attention to pay to what that term actually means, to what it designates, what we refer to when we say we believe in the rule of law. And the good thing about that undertaking, trying to ask what the rule of law means, is that it's not a very complex endeavor. And the reason it's not a complex endeavor is because the rule of law is actually a fairly clear and straightforward term. And the reason it's clear and straightforward is because there is a consensus that transcends the ideological spectrum and even transcends temporal eras about what this term is supposed to mandate. And that is nothing more than the fact that we are all equally bound to a common set of rules, regardless of power, position, or prestige. So you can look to almost any source that defines the rule of law in a credible way. You can look to contemporary legal scholars, and what they'll say is that the rule of law means that nobody is above the law and nobody is below it. And nobody means nobody. Nobody is above the law or nobody, and nobody is below it. More interestingly, you can look to lectures that Western institutions and the United States have been giving to the developing world and the third world for several decades about what the rule of law requires. In the 1980s and the 1990s, there was a movement to demand that any nations that wanted to receive lending from the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank had to be nations that proved to the first world, to the United States, that they were living under the rule of law. And so there was an effort made to sermonize to these countries what exactly it was that we were demanding when we imposed this requirement. And there were lots of articles written towards this end, the most significant, the most influential of which was an article in 1998 by Thomas Carruthers, who worked for a long time at the World Bank, in the journal Foreign Affairs. And this article was intended to essentially be the gospel to developing countries about what they had to do if they wanted to be deemed living under the rule of law. And what Carruthers wrote in this article was that the rule of law means that everyone in your society is bound by the law, that nobody is exempt from it. And what he also said was that the hallmark of a country that fails to live under the rule of law is that your financial elites are able to use their superior economic power to gain exemption from the rule of law. And this, he warns, creates a culture of corruption that produces lawlessness. And we were not going to lend money to countries that were guilty of that pattern. Now, I'm sure you can't even imagine what it's like to live in a country where financial elites are able to use their superior economic force to achieve exemption from the rule of law. This is a horrible thing, but try to imagine that this is what we told those countries they had to stop doing if they wanted to qualify for these lending programs. And then you can look even more interestingly to what the founders of the American Republic said about this question. Because what's really interesting about this is that the founders disagreed on all sorts of things. They had virulent debates and conflicts amongst themselves about a whole litany of issues. And yet one of the things on which they all unanimously agreed, literally unanimously, is that the central prerequisite to having a just and legitimate society was that the rule of law would be not ancillary or secondary as a goal, but would be the central requirement, the principal mandate going forward. And what's even more interesting to me about that is that the founders were people almost across the board, a couple of exceptions, but almost across the board who loved inequality. They were huge fans of inequality, especially wealth inequality and income inequality. They thought that wealth inequality and income inequality were not just inevitable, but desirable and virtuous, which is not surprising since they were almost all very rich. But what they nonetheless emphasized was that the only way that wealth inequality and income inequality and other forms of inequality would be justifiable and legitimate is if we all began being bound by the same set of common rules before the law, that the only way that those inequalities would be the byproduct of merit rather than cheating is if, as Thomas Jefferson put it, even the poorest laborer is on equal footing to the richest multimillionaire before the bar of justice. This was continuously highlighted and emphasized by almost every American founder as the central requirement for a just republic going forward. What has happened over the last several decades, and the reason that I wrote my book, is that it isn't merely that we violate the principle of equality before the law. If that's all that was happening, it wouldn't really be worth a book. In fact, it wouldn't be worth taking up 5 seconds of your time. It's not exactly noteworthy or newsworthy that the United States or any country is failing to comport perfectly with that principle. What has changed radically is that we no longer affirm that principle, at least not in elite opinion-making circles. Instead, it is extremely common to hear people arguing, people in influential venues, to explicitly reject and renounce the principle of equality under the law, to explicitly renounce and reject the validity of the rule of law itself. And I just want to give a couple of examples from my own experience as to when it was that I first realized that this was true. So I began writing about politics full-time in late 2005, and 6 weeks later, 6 weeks after I stopped practicing law and began writing about politics, the New York Times revealed that the Bush administration was spying on American citizens without the warrants required by the criminal law. And this was, to me, a topic of great interest. It was within the realm of my expertise. And more significantly, the reason I began writing about politics was because I perceived there was this growing radicalism and lawlessness in the post-9/11 era, that our political leaders had adopted the view without much resistance that they were all powerful in the name of terrorism, even when it came to disregarding the law. And this was a perfect expression of those radical theories of executive power. And so it's something that I began writing on almost every day. And this was the first time that I began participating in debates on the radio and even on television to talk about this scandal. It was because segment producers and some editors and the like wanted to have some nominal balance, to find somebody who was out there saying that they thought this was a really bad thing and there weren't very many people, and they probably used Google and stumbled into me and so invited me onto these shows. And I remember at the time, I actually thought that this was going to be a fairly straightforward scandal and that the debates in which I participated were going to be fairly clear, and that there would at least be a consensus that emerged almost immediately that when the president of the United States gets caught red-handed doing exactly that which the criminal law says that you cannot do, that at the very least, that was like a bad thing to do. I thought that, I know, it's ridiculous of me to think that, but that was actually the expectation that I had, the assumption that I had, and I thought when I was going to go on these radio programs and these television shows, that the assumption of the discussion was going to be that criminal conduct had taken place and that the real debate would be over how we as a society should punish this criminal behavior. Should we commence a grand jury and indict the officials responsible, or should we simply impeach, or which of those what combination of those remedies would be justifiable given the severity of the crimes? I thought that's what I was going on these shows to debate, and I thought that's what the debate would be. And of course, I went on there and I was asked everything except that. That was exactly the issue that was not part of the discussion. Instead, I was asked things like, well, don't you want the president of the United States listening in when the terrorists are speaking to one another? I mean, don't you want that to happen? Or I would be asked even more commonly, well, how can the Democrats possibly object to what Bush did and still have hopes of winning the 2006 midterm election? I mean, what are you wanting them to do? And I remember at the time, I was literally befuddled by these questions. Like, I was baffled. I was confused. All I could say and all I could think and all I could offer was, I just kept saying over and over, I know, but it's against the law. It's illegal. It's actually a felony. You can go and read the statute, and I promise you it really does say that anyone who spies on the communications of Americans without first going to the FISA court and getting a warrant is guilty of a felony and shall be punished with 5-year prison terms and a $10,000 fine for each offense. And the New York Times reported that the Bush administration had spied on the conversation of thousands of American citizens on American soil. And so it seemed to me pretty obvious that punishment was warranted. And each time I would say this, it wasn't that my argument was rejected or disagreed with. It's that it wasn't acknowledged at all. It couldn't be processed. It was like I was speaking a foreign language. And then I understood this even more strongly when about a year later, the Bush White House demanded that not only the political officials responsible for the spying program, but also the nation's largest telecoms, who had directly participated in these programs by turning over their customers' records to the government and enabling direct spying and interception of their communication without warrants, the Bush White House demanded that they too be fully shielded and immunized from any consequences for this lawbreaking. This immunity that we had seen Bush officials enjoy had now been extended to the private sector as well. And I actively participated in a lot of those debates over whether the telecoms should receive retroactive amnesty for these crimes that they had committed. And it was then that I heard directly and firsthand huge numbers of media stars and political figures making explicit arguments against the rule of law. Their arguments were that because the telecoms were so powerful and important to the functioning of our country, so necessary for the protection of our national security, that it would be not just in their good, but in our common good, good for all of us, if we decided that we would protect them from the implications and the consequences of their lawbreaking by immunizing them retroactively. And this rhetorical approach to justifying elite immunity, that once somebody is sufficiently powerful and instrumental in our country, that it is in all of our good to simply look forward to the glorious future rather than digging in the past and assigning blame, has become normalized when it comes to elite criminality. It's the exact rationale that the Obama administration has used to justify their refusal to investigate the crimes of the Bush era, from the creation of a worldwide torture regime to the aggressive attack on Iraq to multiple episodes of obstruction of justice. It's the same mentality that has led to the full-scale immunization for private sector criminals as well, including the banking industry and Wall Street executives who engaged in systemic fraud that precipitated the 2008 financial crisis. These are the most egregious crimes that can be committed: torture, lawless spying on American citizens, massive fraud, an aggressive attack on another country, and yet not a single one of them has been subject to criminal investigation, let alone prosecution. It's because we have repudiated the rule of law when it comes to elite lawbreakers. And the principle, the slogan that the Obama administration invokes and that President Obama specifically has repeated many times to explain this behavior is that Orwellian slogan of "look forward, good citizens, not backwards. Look to the future and not the past." And what's so amazing about that is the very same Obama administration that has repeatedly invoked this slogan is currently waging what Jane Mayer of The New Yorker described as an unprecedented war on whistleblowers, people who in fairly low or medium level positions in government learn of acts that government leaders undertake that are illegal, corrupt, or otherwise improper, and then disclose it to the public in good conscience by leaking it to reporters or other people like WikiLeaks. And what's amazing about that is many of these acts are way back in the past, in 2002, 2003, 2004, and yet the Obama administration has brought more prosecutions of whistleblowers under espionage claims and counts than all prior presidents combined. And so what we have is, take a look at the National Security Agency scandal that I began by describing. There's only one person who has paid any price from the systemic illegal spying program instituted by George Bush that the New York Times exposed. And his name is Thomas Tam. And Thomas Tan was a mid-level Justice Department attorney who in 2005 learned that Bush officials were spying on Americans without the warrants required by law. And one day he couldn't take it any longer and he picked up the phone and he called Eric Lichtblau at the New York Times and told Eric Lichtblau what he had learned, which is what led to the Pulitzer Prize winning story being published by the Times. Thomas Tan was fired from his job. He had a grand jury convened against him to investigate whether he had broken the law by disclosing classified information, meaning exposing the criminal eavesdropping program. He had subpoenas issued for him. He couldn't afford his lawyers. He eventually ended up in personal bankruptcy. All the people who actually committed those crimes that he exposed have been fully immunized. In fact, most of them are on book tours making huge amounts of money. And yet Thomas Tan, the person who exposed the criminality, is the only one who has suffered. The Obama administration dispensed with this look forward, not backward mantra when it came to punishing the people who exposed the high-level criminality. That's the two-tier justice system personified. Now, one last point about how this two-tier justice system works, and that is that in the post-9/11 era, we have created an even lower classification than ordinary Americans get when they commit crimes. That is people who are accused of being terrorists. In that world, for that class of people, including American citizens arrested on American soil, there is no law of any kind. It is a world of pure lawlessness. They are subpersons, subhumans, literally, who receive not even the pretense of due process the way ordinary Americans do. They can be arrested and detained and even killed without any due process of any kind. So one of the first episodes that really impelled me to start writing about politics and stop practicing law because of this growing radicalism that I perceived was when the Bush administration asserted the power to arrest American citizens on American soil and detain them without charges for as long as the president wanted. And that's what happened to an American citizen named Jose Padilla, who was arrested in April of 2002 at Chicago O'Hare International Airport and immediately transferred to a military brig in South Carolina, where he remained for the next 3.5 years without charges of any kind, and in fact held incommunicado, prohibited from any communication with the outside world, his family, and even lawyers. And he was tortured there to the point where he is permanently psychologically damaged. And this was a huge controversy among Democrats and progressives, the idea that the Bush administration would assert the power to detain American citizens without due process. That was the epitome of radicalism. Until it was revealed that the Obama administration is asserting the power, not just to eavesdrop on American citizens without warrants, and not just to detain our fellow citizens without due process, but to target them for death far away from a battlefield. And that's exactly what the Obama administration has not only asserted, but carried out when they targeted for assassination the American-born cleric Anwar al-Awlaki, who was killed by a drone attack in Yemen after being targeted for assassination while riding in a car with two friends, one of whom was also an American citizen, collateral damage. And 2 weeks after that, al-Awlaki's 16-year-old son, also an American citizen, born in the United States, and his 17-year-old cousin had their lives ended by a separate drone attack that was sent to Yemen as well. So here we have literally the most radical act, the most lawless and tyrannical act that a government can possibly seize, literally, the power to target its own citizens in complete secrecy, with no charges of any kind, no evidence presented of their guilt, no transparency, no checks or balances. And that is as much of an evisceration of the rule of law as one can imagine.
We'll be right back with more from author Glenn Greenwald. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. Because of listeners like you, this show is distributed for free to radio stations in the U.S., Canada, and South Africa. To find out how to support us, download shows, or get our podcasts, go to radioproject.org. We now return to Glenn Greenwald, speaking in November 2011 in Berkeley, California, about his book, With Liberty and Justice for Some.
I want to talk about one of what I think is the main implication of having created this two-tier justice system. It isn't just that extreme injustice is generated when we have multi-tier justice systems depending on who you are rather than what you do, although that is true. And it isn't just that we essentially eviscerate and abandon the rule of law by doing that, although that's also true. I think it's much more subtle than that and yet much more insidious. The real implication of this development is that law ceases to become what it was intended to be, which is the legitimizing anchor for everything done in the society, the guarantor of equal treatment by our government, and it becomes the exact opposite. It becomes a coercive weapon wielded by the powerful to entrench their power and punish those who challenge or subvert them. And the signal that's being sent is we, the people who run the American government and the people who control and own it, we do not act with the constraints of law. We can do whatever it is we want to you, and there's nothing anyone can do about it. And not only that, but we can use the law and manipulate the law to turn anyone who challenges us into a heinous criminal who can then be punished under the pretense of legalism and legality and law, and there's nothing anyone can do about that either. So if you're somebody who learns of something that we did in secret that is illegal or corrupt or improper, and you are thinking about exposing what we did to the world, take a look at Bradley Manning and what we were able to do to him. Or if you're a Muslim living in a Muslim country who wants to impose our bombing and occupation and invading of your country, take a look at what we've done to all of your neighbors or to thousands of people that we've arrested and put into black holes with no due process of any kind. It's a way of sending a signal of deterring anybody who might challenge or in any way meaningfully dissent from those in power. I think this really was vividly illustrated for me during the time that I was writing a lot about WikiLeaks. The first time I ever wrote about WikiLeaks was in January of 2010. And this was really before very many people knew anything about WikiLeaks. It was before they had even posted the video of the Apache helicopter in Baghdad slaughtering Iraqi civilians and journalists. And I didn't know much about WikiLeaks either. The way that I had learned about WikiLeaks was that the Pentagon in 2008 had prepared a report that they classified as top secret. And in this report, they declared WikiLeaks to be what they called an enemy of the state, and they plotted ways that they could go about rendering it inoperable, destroying it. They talked about exposing their sources so that nobody would have confidence leaking to them. They talked about manufacturing fraudulent documents that they would then to submit to WikiLeaks in the hope they would publish it and destroy its credibility. They talked about cutting off their funding sources to choke their ability to operate. The way that I know about this top secret report, you could probably guess, ironically, is that somebody leaked it to WikiLeaks and they published it on the internet. I read everything about WikiLeaks that I could, and I saw that they had engaged in some very impressive leaks outside the United States against other governments and corporations. And I wrote a long article detailing all the reasons I thought WikiLeaks held such promise. And I interviewed Julian Assange, and I published the audio of the interview as well. And at the end of this article that I wrote, I encouraged people to donate money to WikiLeaks. I provided a link how they could wire money to their bank account. I provided a PayPal link how they could donate online. And in response to that article, I had dozens of people, literally, in all kinds of venues, in my comment section to the article, by email, in events like this, who came up to me and said some variation of, well, look, I absolutely agree with you about what you said about WikiLeaks. I think they hold great promise. I support what they do, and I wish I could help them in any way. The problem that I'm having is that I'm actually concerned that if I donate money to them electronically, that I will end up on some government list somewhere, or potentially even be subjected to criminal liability if at some point in the future they're declared a terrorist organization, I could be charged with materially supporting a terrorist group. And the reason I found that so striking was because WikiLeaks is an organization that had never been and has never been even charged with a crime, let alone convicted of a crime. They cannot be charged with a crime because what they're doing is pure First Amendment activity. It's what the New York Times and CNN claims to do, which is receiving sensitive government secrets about high-level wrongdoing and exposing it to the world. It's the core of what a free press is intended to be. It's impossible to criminalize what they do, and yet here were dozens of American citizens petrified of exercising the most basic First Amendment right, which is what donating money to a political organization whose cause you support is. And that's when I realized just how potent this climate of fear that's been created actually is, that comes from the government announcing as proudly and clearly as can be that they are not constrained by law of any kind. You can offer all the rights you want on a piece of paper or a piece of parchment. But if you intimidate the citizenry from exercising those rights become meaningless. It's actually a more effective means of tyranny than overtly retracting the rights in a way that's obvious. And I think you see the same thing with how the state and various police agencies, which are really just the arm of these elites, are responding to Occupy Wall Street and the various movements that have been created around the country. Because that, too, is a way of signaling to citizens that if you challenge prevailing power, you, too, can be harmed and crushed because we, the state and its agents and its owners, do not operate with the constraints of law. It's a way of coercing the citizenry and intimidating them from challenging what the state is doing. It's the same reason why Bradley Manning is stripped naked and held in solitary confinement, or WikiLeaks is destroyed with no due process, or war on terror victims are dressed in orange jumpsuits and tortured. They want you to know that they operate in a world of lawlessness because that's what is supposed to instill fear. So now to finish up this analysis, I just want to highlight what I think is the principal consequence of all of this, the reason why I find this to be such an important topic. And that is, roughly speaking, you can effectuate political change, meaningful political change, in one of two ways. You can either work within the political and legal institutions to bring about the change. You can support candidates or give money to political parties or canvass for votes and all of that. Or once you conclude that the political and legal institutions are radically corrupted, then the only viable option becomes demanding change outside of the system. And I think more than anything else, that is what this Occupy movement is about, and what has driven it is the belief, I think the clearly accurate belief, that our political and legal institutions are so completely co-opted that change is no longer able to be effectuated within it. It doesn't matter really which party wins, they're captive to the same interests, the same secretive functions of our shadow government, the national security state, the lobbyist class continue to exercise untrammeled power, that real change can come only from outside of this political system. Mere inequality, it's pretty clear, would not sustain or even fuel a protest movement like the one we're seeing. We've had extreme levels of wealth and income inequality for decades. It's been exploding for three decades since the Reagan era. So Americans are relatively content with large amounts of income inequality if they perceive that it's fair and meritocratic and legitimate. So for example, when Steve Jobs dies and has $8 billion, people, by and large, don't begrudge that because the perception is that he earned it. He played within the rules. He invented technologies that improved the lives of tens of millions of people. And so there wasn't really anger over the mere inequality that he has $8 billion and other people are losing their homes. What people are angry about is that these inequalities have become unjust and unfair, that they're illegitimate. And the reason they're illegitimate is because the people winning are not winning because they earned it or because they deserved it. They're winning because they're cheating. These are ill-gotten gains that they are using their power over our legal and political institutions to protect and shield and enhance at everybody else's expense. And it's this perception of illegitimacy that our political and legal institutions have become inherently illegitimate that have turned huge numbers of people off of the idea of working within the democratic system because it's not democratic, it's oligarchic. And instead has sent them into the streets because that's the only viable option that remains. So with that, I thank you very much for listening tonight. It was great to be with you.
That's it for this edition of Making Contact. To hear a full, unedited version of Glenn Greenwald's November 2011 speech, log on to our website, radioproject.org. Special thanks to KPFA Radio in Berkeley. I'm Andrew Stelzer. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.